We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson, the producer for the show, at the controls this hour. Jason Croft, Kyle Mabry, was on for hour number one. Easter Island is a place that is known around the world for its monumental statuary, and probably all I have to do is say the name of the place, and you can close your eyes and picture in your mind the statues that I am talking about. It has also been a great puzzle for a very long time, because from the point that Europeans came there and saw the place and saw these statues, they asked questions about who made them and how it is they managed to make them and what was their significance. And ultimately, the question, well, what happened to the society that lived there? And it has been for some time now, for some people, a classic kind of cautionary tale about what happens to people when they don't take care of their environment. The story has been that the people living there, they destroyed their local environment, and in the process, they destroyed their society. However, the guest that we have for this hour, archaeologist Carl Lippo, says, well, he has a rather different idea. In fact, that was what he thought when he first started doing work at the place. He was expecting to find evidence that would support that view. Contrary to that, he argues that the people of Easter Island actually were pretty good environmental managers, and it may be that the biggest problems that they had to deal with were brought to the island by Europeans. You will find all of this in a recent book that he has co-authored with Terry Hunt, who teaches anthropology at University of Hawaii at Manoa. The title of the book is The Statues That Walked. The subtitle is Unraveling the Mystery of Easter Island. It's published by the Free Press and out now, so if you'd like to take a look at it. And, of course, questions are welcome to 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. And also, if you'd like to send us an email, well, you can do that too. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. Our guest, Carl Lippo, is professor of archaeology at California State University, Long Beach, and he's joining us this morning by phone. And Professor Lippo, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks. By the way, am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Yes, Lippo, yes.
Okay, good. Very good. Well, thanks for being with us. We certainly appreciate it. Maybe the place to start out would be I can ask you to tell the Easter Island story that is sort of has been the conventional narrative, this story that says that, well, when the people got there, when the Easter Islanders got there, it was a tropical paradise.
Yes.
But it ultimately was because of the way they lived, the place became devastated, and then as a result of an ecological collapse, then there was in fact this social collapse of the Easter Island society.
This narrative, this idea that these people who lived on Easter Island sort of did themselves in, mm-hmm. comes from some of the earliest observations that Europeans made when they encountered the island after 1722, when the Dutch arrived, the first Europeans to arrive on the island. What they found was, a small island. It's only 6 by 10 miles across. It's really isolated. It's incredibly remote. Sort of surprisingly found this island in the middle of the Pacific. And even more surprisingly, they found people living on the island. And then to top that, they found that these people that were living on this island had made and moved these massive statues that weighed 20 to 30 tons and moved it across, across the island. More than 400 statues were moved, perhaps as much as 6 miles. And this sort of, of course, attracted a lot of interest to Europeans. Like, well, how could this possibly have happened? How could such a small place have created such giant statues? And when they looked around, they saw relatively few people, and certainly nothing that reminded Europeans at that time of themselves, other people who would be capable of making such monuments. And right from the beginning, people started to think, well, something different. Now, at least when European times, than what happened in the past, that something must have changed. And this sort of try to put it into context, has led people to sort of assume that something, whatever we're seeing today, can't be representative of the past. And what's been assumed is that, well, people, and this has come over a couple centuries of research and speculation, is that when people first got to the island, they encountered a very large palm forest. This is when prehistoric people, the Rapa Nui people, got to the island. And they encountered a large prehistoric forest, and the island was covered with trees. And over time, we know that those trees went away. When Europeans arrive, they don't find any trees. They find a pretty barren place, but they find statues. So people have assumed that there's an association between the change in the environment, the loss of the forest, and the creation of the statues, that there must be a link between these two things, and that potentially one caused the other, that the creation of the statues and all this monumental architecture activity led to the destruction of the forest. And certainly it makes a lot of sense. I mean, we see this all the time. When populations arrive to places, they do stuff and they change things, and often not necessarily for the better. And, of course, that concerns us, and it's become a sort of a touchstone case for ourselves to look at, to say, well, we need to avoid doing this, to not do this. And so this story has become really embedded. People have assumed that that's what's happened, that this is a good case of it, people causing their own environmental destruction.
Yeah, and we'll talk in some detail. We can take the story apart and talk in some detail about it and what evidence there may or may not be for that. But I think in the book you say that, in fact, when you started to do archaeological work on the island, when you went there, you expected that the archaeological evidence would support that story. And in fact, one of the things that you argue now in the book is, well, actually, once you get into and you start looking at the evidence doesn't support that story.
Yeah, like we talk about in the book, that really did go there thinking, here's a small place, archaeologically really easy to study because it's, 6 by 10 miles. You can really map everything on the island. The history is pretty well known as far as people arrived here and then, populations grew. There's been a lot of work done, so that my initial interest, and it still is why would people do this thing, making these statues in the first place? Why, what was behind that? But we assume that the story was entirely well known, and certainly the way it's been talked about, it's like, well, that's a given. And when we started doing research and doing excavations, and we realized that a lot of the things that people assume to be true, for example, when people first arrived on the island, evidence for a pre-European contact collapse. In other words, that people were making statues and involved in all this activity, but then stopped doing it with some civil unrest prior to Europeans arriving. That all these things, there wasn't any evidence for, that this was assumed to be the story, but it wasn't true, that there just wasn't any data to support it.
Well, this particular point would be really, depending on what kind of story you want to tell here and talk about when the collapse happened and why, the date people arrived would be really important there. And, some
Absolutely.
People have said that the people might have arrived there as early as 300. I think the figure that people tell this narrative that you outlined said maybe 900. You and I think, and your co-author here argue that it was probably a lot later than that.
This is where we first sort of realized something was off. We were excavating in the place that most people recognize, at least as far as we know, one of the earliest deposits on the island. There's not much of a beach shore on the island, and this one area, Anakena Beach, has beach deposits. And it's a perfect place that early settlers would arrive and settle because you could access it and you could get to the ocean, and it would make sense. I mean, the other place, there's lots of cliffs and things that would be very inhospitable. So we were excavating there, and people had done previous excavations and argued that this was early deposits. And when we excavated down to the very bottom of our excavations, we found a layer that was, we could see evidence of palm trees, where palm trees had been growing. And palm trees, we know, were cut down, and there were palm trees prior to when people first arrived on the island. But when we got so we knew this was a very early surface, or that, should date to when people first arrived. But when we got the dates, we got dates of 1200 AD, much three to seven hundred years later than what everybody had been saying. Now that it seems like a small, what's the difference between 300 and 500 years? But it started to cause us to question, well, if that's not right, then what else might not be right? The longer dates have always been key in the story, and sort of the longer narrative, people got there and it was this tropical paradise, and they were at one with the environment for a long time, and then they started to make statues, and then things sort of spun out of control, and that there was never, there was sort of a time that we could look back to that was the perfect state. And what we found is that people got there at 1200, at least the evidence from all the dates, and immediately started making statues, and there was no imbalance period. People immediately started to change their environment. So that whole sort of tropical paradise thing never happened. And that made us wonder, okay, well, what else didn't happen? It also meant that a collapse would have to happen in a growth and then collapse would have to happen in a much shorter period of time. People got there at 1200. We know Europeans arrived there in 1722, so that's only 500 years for the entire story, population settlement, growth, some sort of peak expansion, and then collapse, and then Europeans arrive. And that's sort of like, wait a second, well, I wonder, how could all of that have happened in that relatively short period of time? Mm. And then we found, well, that sort of lead us down different paths. And you're like, wow, there's a lot of this is just made up.
Well, let me again introduce the guest. Carl Lippo is professor of archaeology at California State University, Long Beach. He is the co-author, along with Terry Hunt, who teaches at University of Hawaii, the co-authors of the book The Statues That Walked, and the subtitle Unraveling the Mystery of Easter Islands, published by the Free Press, and really takes on what has been the standing narrative for some time about Easter Island, about who these people were, what they did, what the society was like, and the impact on the environment. And we'll continue to talk, and questions are welcome. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Well, one of the big questions here is what happened to this prehistoric palm forest that was there on the island when the people got there. It was there in 1200 when they got there, and sometime in the next couple of hundred years, it went away. And some people have argued that, well, it must have been that the Easter Islanders cut the trees down, and somehow that gets tied to the statue making. And maybe also in a couple of respects, in terms of using lumber that you might use to move them. And then another thing we'll get to, it, it has to do with how many people there were and how do you feed them and so forth and so on. But you make a really interesting and novel argument about what it was that happened to the trees. And you say, well, you're not so sure if this is a case of deforestation by humans.
Well, yeah. We know humans are involved one way or the other. I mean, the event of humans arriving certainly triggers some changes. But Polynesians across the entire Pacific, whenever they arrived, they would introduce new plants and new animals that they carried with them. And one animal that they'd always carry with them, whether it was intentional or not, it's unclear, is the rat, the Polynesian rat, Rattus excellens. And the Polynesian rat is a tree rat. It likes to, it's arboreal. It likes to live up in trees, and it loves palm nuts. So we know that's the case. And our excavations in the earliest levels show thousands of rat bones. It has the highest percentage of all the different kinds of bones of animals we find. Rats are the largest number, and so we know that the rats got there. And what made us start to question, ask questions like, well, what would that have necessarily meant with the introduction of rats? And we've with doing research on other islands and other people in the Pacific have started to recognize the strong role that rats have in changing environments that are sort of independent of humans entirely. And so we imagine an environment where with no predators, no natural predators, and rats get introduced, there's a palm forest filled with what rats love to eat, palm nuts, and you introduce a couple of rats. What must happen? I mean, there's almost no way this couldn't have happened. There must have been millions of rats, several years after people first get there. And certainly, indeed, that seems to be the case. I mean, just from the excavation excavation information that the bones, the faunal remains, are mostly rat. That must have changed the forest. I mean, without humans at all, that must have changed the way in which these palm trees would propagate. If rats were eating all of the nuts and sprouts and anything that would the trees would grow, then the trees couldn't replicate themselves. They couldn't reproduce. And these are very slow-growing trees. The tree that was on the island is called Jubea chileensis. It's a relative of the Chilean wine palm. And this tree grows to about 500 years. It takes about 70 years to fruit. It's a very slow-growing tree. So if you have rats predating on all the nuts and not allowing those to be seeded, then you're going to change the forest, whether or not humans ever did anything else. Now, humans, we know, burned trees down as well. These were people who cultivated the land and were slash-and-burn agriculturists. So we know that they were also chopping trees. But the combination of humans doing what they were just doing, not necessarily purposely, you know, let's eliminate this forest, but just grow, you know, burning trees to enrich soils to grow crops, and then the actions of rats, the forest is just going to go away. And in fact, we see from the evidence of the charcoal evidence, we have the trees start being burned at about 1200 AD, and then about over the next 400 years, there's evidence of continuous burning through that. So it takes 400 years for this to happen. It's not a big single event. It's a long process.
Another part of this story that, and again, I suppose it gets back to this narrative that this should be taken as a lesson of what happens when people don't take care of the environment. That is, that people were careless of their environment, that they did a lot of clearing of the land. So whether that was either because they needed the wood to move statues, and we'll talk about that, or they just needed land to farm to support the population. That what we had was, so the trees were cut down or taken away. You had major erosion problem. It made the land less productive. And ultimately, that led to food shortage and led to war.
Yeah.
Well, you make a different kind of argument that says, well, actually, maybe this was not such a great place for farming ever. And that people really did pretty well trying to deal with very difficult growing conditions.
Yeah, that's an important point. It's often easy to imagine when people say Polynesia to think of the classic, you know, central Polynesia, Tahiti, the Society Islands, Marquesas, these tropical lands with fruit trees. And, you know, you can sit on the beach and get coconuts and eat mangoes and, you know, and not have to do any work. That's the environment is very rich and productive. And Easter Island is not that island. Easter Island is actually subtropical. It's pretty far south. It's minus 27 degrees south, which makes it, you know, has some seasonality in terms of cold and warm, and it's not the most productive island. It's also an old island in terms of a volcanic island. And an old volcanic island, what happens is with rainfall, all the minerals that are in the soil tend to get leached out over a period of time. So when people first got there, they found a palm forest, but it wasn't necessarily a productive island in and of itself. The palms were there, but with the introduction of rats, the palm nuts weren't. You probably couldn't even get them because the rats would get them before you could. And so you had to deal with stuff other than the palm trees in terms of food. And the soil itself was nutrient poor, so it would just barely allow you to grow some of your basic crops, which are, for the Polynesians, sweet potato and taro, banana, sugarcane, some other things, but largely sweet potato and taro. These were barely growable. So people had to deal with this fact that they had this forested island that, you know, had trees and nuts, but you couldn't get them, and then poor soils. And what we think happened is that people would burn, this is very common in agriculturalists, is to burn the forest and to turn it into nutrients, put it back into the soil, because the nutrients essentially are bound in the trees. And by burning them, you put them back into the soil, and you can grow your crops, and that enriched the soil. So what we're really seeing, we believe we see in terms of the prehistory of Easter Island, is that people are actually transforming the island from a very unproductive island, from a human perspective, into a productive one. It's actually the opposite of what the story is, you know, typically told, that they're making it into something that actually is sustainable rather than something that couldn't sustain people.
Mm. There's another part of the story that goes that political disputes, factions between people, no doubt exacerbated by growing environmental problems and the inability to feed the population, ultimately led to war and a civil war and people killing each other and even cannibalism. So that story is told. And apparently people, even after the Europeans got there, people told stories about how there had been this terrible period of war on the island. Again, you make the argument that looking at the evidence, this story about war and cannibalism, the evidence, again, just doesn't support that.
Yeah, a lot of what we think we know about the island in terms of its prehistory comes from oral traditions that were collected in the 20th century. I mean, so Europeans arrive in 1722, but it's not until 1915 that in fact some of the oral traditions are being written down. So it's quite 200 years after initial contact. So a lot of those don't necessarily reflect what was prehistoric, and certainly probably reflect a lot of things that were going on that happened after Europeans arrived. Our first sort of inclination that something was odd with the evidence for warfare and cannibalism came from just looking at the archaeological record to find out, well, where are the defensive structures? If people were fighting, where were they defending? You know, this everywhere else on the Pacific, when we look at evidence of fighting, we see it. We see forts on tops of hills. Because, given warfare where you're throwing rocks at each other or, stabbing each other, being on tops of things is the way to naturally the sort of defensive structures. And you don't see any of that. All the tops of the hills across the entire island are completely empty, nothing up there. That sort of made me wonder, like, well, how could that be? And when we started to look at the skeletal evidence, there are burials, and people have studied those burials, have almost no lethal trauma. In other words, no evidence of actually any warfare. And then we started to look at the weapons themselves that people call weapons that say that were part of this warfare, and we find that they're not particularly useful for killing anything. The evidence suggests that they're just being used for scraping and cutting plants. They're not for stabbing people that you would expect, and that you see anywhere that you find warfare, that you see. These things are agricultural tools, implements. We found no evidence of this kind of behavior. So we started to look at the question, well, where does this come from? And we see that, again, it comes from oral traditions, and it comes from oral traditions that are very late, and that often can be even introduced. The evidence for cannibalism, for example, looks like the first mention of cannibalism appears when the French missionaries, Catholic missionaries, arrive on the island. That becomes assumed that the prehistory has cannibalism. But there's actually no other evidence for it, and it arrives exactly when people, French missionaries who were working elsewhere where there was cannibalism, come to the island and then assume that it must be part of the past. So it looks like it's entirely introduced. It's a post-contact story that gets made and then assumed.
Well, it's certainly one thing that certainly does seem to be true. If you look at the history of the island, is that what was very, I'm sure the people who lived there had a whole lot of challenges that they had to deal with, but certainly what was very hard on the people was the coming of the Europeans.
Yeah, I think, people, we've heard a number of, lots of different cases, North America, Australia, the other places where Europeans arrive, and certainly across the Pacific, and there's big impacts. Personally, I don't think that we really appreciate the degree of those impacts. The degree to which disease really changed populations. These populations, and it's not on purpose by the Europeans, it's just sort of historical accident. Europeans evolved because Europeans have a long history of domesticated animals, cows, goats, pigs. They actually got a lot of diseases that were introduced into European populations through the domesticated animals. And Europeans sort of historically lived with their domesticated animals, literally in the houses animals would live in there, and so it was really easy for diseases to go through those populations and get introduced. These other populations in North America and the Pacific never had as many domesticated animals and certainly not the same kinds of animals, and they never were exposed to these kinds of diseases. And so Europeans arrive and they bring these diseases that these populations had never encountered and had never evolved to have any immunities for, and it's devastating. It's absolutely devastating. And Europeans that in North America, the estimates of population loss is somewhere around, in some places, up to 95%. I mean, millions of people died very quickly and long before most Europeans and sort of writing histories and observing things ever saw. And this certainly seems to be the case in Easter Island. What we see, the Dutch arrive in 1722, and they're not very, very long, and they probably had some impact in disease, but it's 50 years before people come back. In 1770, the Spanish arrive. Well, the Spanish spend a couple of weeks. They certainly introduce disease one way or the other. This is all pre-germ theory. Europeans don't know what, causes the diseases and what spreads them. And so certainly water supplies were polluted and other things, and Europeans wouldn't have known. The Spanish, of course, don't see much in the way of disease. They're only there for 2 weeks. But the English arrive 2 years later, and they find a devastated landscape. They find they describe skeletons on the ground, toppled statues, really something that's a society that's really gone through some major changes. And that seems to be the big triggering point. Once after the Spanish, it really is a changed environment. Disease has really impacted people, and it's what once was a healthy population, as Roggeveen reports, healthy population providing food for the Europeans who arrive, suddenly is a population that can barely support itself.
Mm. And also another way that the Europeans affected the people of the island was they took slaves there.
Yes. The history, sort of one of the most tragic, unwritten histories, now being documented, is the historic events that went through this island. Slavery was outlawed in North America, but it was actually still legal in South America and had moved to the Pacific. And there was a long sort of late history of slavery across the Pacific where people, South Americans, would go into these islands and take 1,000 people and bring them to work on guano mines and different kinds of slave environments. And that was, would just destroy populations. The Europeans objected to this. The French actually saw this happening to Easter Island, all these people being taken off of Easter Island, and objected to the Spanish and the South Americans taking them. And they brought the people back, but of course that just made even things worse by bringing back diseases to the island. So at one point in the 1870s, there were only 111 native Rapa Nui people alive on the island.
In this hour, we're talking with Carl Lippo. We're talking about Easter Island. He's an archaeologist who has done work there. He teaches at California State University, Long Beach. And his authored book, The Statues That Walked. And we'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the books and religious beliefs that have influenced Michelle Bachman with Ryan Lizza. He profiles Bachman in the current edition of The New Yorker. A New York Times reporter, Andrea Elliott, talks about the man behind the movement to create state laws banning Sharia law. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings, and we have 10 different topics for you each week. Tomorrow morning, in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll have our regular monthly program on diet and nutrition. Celeste Quinn is the host. She'll be talking with registered dietitian Sarah Jane Bedwell. And then in the second hour, the 11 o'clock, I will welcome back here one of our friends and favorite guests, May Barenbaum. She's head of the Department of Entomology here at the U of I. She's a scientist who studies insects, and we talk about insects, not how to exterminate them, but we try to appreciate them for the many varied ways they live their lives. So if you have questions about bugs that you have seen, we'll take them. You'd like to check up on the schedule, find out what we will do for the rest of the week and next week. You go to our website, will.illinois.edu. That way you can also listen to past programs. In this hour of Focus, our guest is Carl Lippo. He is a professor of archaeology at California State University, Long Beach, is the co-author, along with Terry Hunt, who's professor of anthropology at University of Hawaii. They're the co-authors of the book, The Statues That Walked, Unraveling the Mystery of Easter Island, published by the Free Press. And as we have explained, they're going to take on what has been the common narrative about Easter Island, that is that when the people got there, it was a tropical paradise. It was covered in forest. a society developed there that was focused on ancestor worship. They became obsessed with carving these giant statues, carving more and more, cutting down trees to move them. The land was cleared to grow food for all the people involved in that labor. The population grew so big, feeding everybody became a problem. Then war broke out, and eventually people turned to cannibalism. That was sort of the story that people told. And it was a cautionary tale about what happens when people don't take care of the environment. He explains that when he went there to do archaeological work, he expected to find evidence for that story, but he said very quickly it seemed that the evidence was pointing to something different. So you can read about it in the book, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, the next big area here, and we can probably spend the rest of our time talking some about the statues, is this is the thing that, you know, people think Easter Island, you, as I said at the beginning, you close your eyes, you can see these statues, and they have captivated people for, you know, as long as outsiders have been able to come there. So let's talk about what do we know about what these giant statues meant to the people who made them?
We know the statue construction and sort of putting figures on high spots is something that's very common in Polynesia. It's consistent with Polynesian traditions of honoring ancestors. You put, you know, your elders up on a high place. And we know that this is something that's very pan-Pacific, pan-Polynesian. In fact, the tiki tradition that you know, that people have heard about in Hawaii and Tahiti is exactly the same. In fact, they're very similar kinds of figures. They're just made, in Easter Island, there's lots of them, and they have very large made out of stone. There are actually other stone statues across the Pacific at islands Reliavavai and elsewhere. They're actually similar statues to the ones on Easter Island. But Easter Island, of course, the most, you know, most famous for them. But it seems to be something that's very, you know, very Polynesian and certainly related to ancestor worship.
Hmm. And I guess one of the things that I thought was interesting, I suppose I never really thought about this, was that you can tell something about them by the fact that they're facing in.
Yes.
And not facing out.
Yeah, it's an important point because people often think, oh, these statues are like are guarding or facing other people. But if you put yourself on the island, Easter Island is 1,500 miles from any other speck of land, which is the closest one is Pitcairn, but really 2,000 miles from any place with people. And it's you know, it's on its own. And from the point of view of people living there over 500 years, that there isn't any other world other than the island itself. So why put statues facing outwards if, you know, their universe consists of the island? And these statues, these you know, in terms of ancestors, they're there to look over the people who are on the island. And so we find them on platforms on the coast, but facing inland, looking at the people. So the people do stuff and have activities, but then, you know, looking up at the statues and behind them is the sea.
Yeah. So again, going back to the sort of the standard story, was first of all, people looked at these big things and had some. They sort of knew well where these things were quarried and where they were made, and they thought, well, you know, somehow to do this, to make these monumental statues, to make them and to transport them, you would need a lot of people. This would be a big undertaking. It would be almost like pyramid building. You know, you would need these vast numbers of people just to do this. So the story was that this was done at the command of some central authority, and we would need all these people to do it, and that led to some other problems. So that gets to this question of, well, what does anybody think at the peak the population of the island might have been, or maybe it would have had to have been, if you know, depending on how it is you think about this whole statue business.
Yeah, in a lot of writings about Easter Island, you often see a sort of a population growth curve that starts out, you know, in the beginning of it begins whenever you think the people first got there, and there's a little small population. It grows and grows and grows, and then there's a peak and it drops just before Europeans arrive. That's sort of the classic population growth and boom and bust kind of curve. We found that when I, you know, sort of looking at that, it turned out to be entirely made up in terms of people. The curve is created to what it must be, quote unquote. You know, what must that have been? It isn't really based on any evidence. Estimates, when people looked at the statues, they said, well, there must be a lot of people involved in this. And this comes from Europeans thinking about, from their perspective, if we want to build a cathedral, say, we need a lot of people, or a pyramid. You need armies, and you need to have people in command and in charge, and engineers, and some king, you know, saying we must build this. And so they assume, well, that since we didn't, they didn't see that on the island at the time, they assume, well, but it must have been true in the past. Therefore, what we see is something that represents a downfall in society, a crash society, a collapsed society. But in the past, it had to have been there. So estimates for populations get as much as 10 to 15,000 people, which would be, you know, what you might think, you know, again, would be consistent with sort of a European scale, you know, moving these kinds of things. Turns out not to be, there's no evidence for that on many levels. From the point of view of looking at the archaeological records themselves of houses and dispersed settlements and where people are living, there isn't evidence for that many people. And there's certainly no evidence of it getting really larger than crashing in that way in a prehistoric fashion. So that made it, when we started looking at the record, we said, well, there just aren't big villages or towns, and there's no evidence of chiefs and places like that. So how then were the statues moved? And a colleague of ours, Sergio Rapu, who's a Rapa Nui archaeologist who lives on the island, he made a comment about the statues that really made us think. He said, well, look, they're certainly very talented people. The carvers who made them were very talented. They could make the statues look however they wanted to. They could make the eyes, and there's lots of variability in the shape and the nose and the ears and the head, and, you know, that wasn't really the problem. The problem, he said, is you have to move them. In order to get them from where you have to design them and make them so that you can get them from the quarry, the place where they're sourced, to the places where you want them to go. And so if you look at the statues in terms of things that must be true in order for them to be moved, you can then figure out how they were moved, because you would see the things that the constraints that are on the statues themselves. And in fact, that's what we started to do, and look at the features of the statues themselves, and we realized that these things were made specifically to move, and not because they weren't made. If you could have a crane, for example, you could make a statue look however you wanted in whatever shape or size you wanted. But these statues, as they got bigger, they started to look more and more alike. And they look more and more like bowling pins, where there's a bottom-heavy, forward center of gravity. And it demonstrated that these statues were actually moved standing up, which is mind-blowing. But it turns out to make sense. We move refrigerators across our kitchen every day or so, standing up. We don't lay them on the back and then get a bunch of people and carry them across the kitchen. One person can shuffle a refrigerator across the kitchen. In the same way, statues were moved in a way that was most efficient and built to do that, which really means that it didn't take as many people to move the statues. Again, that also is consistent with what we see archaeologically, with not evidence of huge populations, large villages, and that kind of thing.
So this is really interesting, because I'm sure if you thought about it, you'd think, okay, how would you go about moving this thing? And I imagine most people would think, well, what you have to do is you got to put it on its back.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Then, you know, you get a bunch of logs. You know the concept. You put these logs down, and then you lay it on its back on the logs, and you start rolling. And you roll it a little bit, and then once you roll it off the, you know, one log, then you pick up that log and rush around, and you put it in the front again.
Yeah.
And you continue to, you know, so you do that, and in this painstaking way, you move your logs, and you'd need enough people to pull the thing, and you'd have to have other people moving the logs. So that sort of says, well, you need so many people to do this, and then it also says, well, you got to get the logs somewhere. Well, you got all these palm trees. Well, yeah. I guess that means you cut down your palm trees to make the logs to move the statues, and you make this whole story up based on that idea that that's how you move them. But what's really interesting is you're saying, no, in fact, that's what the title of the book is all about. You're saying, no, they didn't move them on their backs. They moved them standing up.
Yeah, certainly you could lay them down on their backs, but they're not. You can see that they're not made to do that. They're actually weak right at the neck part. You know, so if you lay them in the back, you're actually more likely to break them than you are to move them. The assumption has always been, of course, that's if we needed to move a big thing, we'd put it on wheels and some kind of roller system, and so assume, well, that must be the way they must have done it. But that's, you know, there's really no evidence at all that that was the case. And we first sort of thinking about this because we looked at the trees, the palm trees, which people assume were the rollers. Palm trees are actually in the grass family. They're not like hardwood trees. They have a hard exterior, but the inside is sort of mush, and they're more like empty barrels. So these things aren't the kind of tree you would use for rollers in the first place. So that sort of led us to think, well, wait a second, if trees are really used for rollers, trees can't be used for rollers because they're not that same kind of trees. And people have certainly done experiments showing that they could roll statues with rollers of some sort, but they've used eucalyptus tree or some kind, non-palm tree, the Jabea palm, just couldn't have served that purpose. So that's in addition to starting to look at the statues, suggested that there's no way we could explain that they just weren't moved that way. They, certainly it's plausible, but these statues weren't moved that way.
So I do find myself thinking about I think your example of moving the fridge is a good one. That somehow you can manage to kind of tilt it a little bit and then shove it over one way and tilt it a little bit and shove it over the other way, and that eventually you can, who knows, it would take a while, but you actually could walk them that way from where they were quarried to the places that they ended up.
Exactly, and we're pretty good at, we don't even think about it, that's the way we move. If we have a few people and a big heavy thing, we, sort of optimize the way we can least amount of energy input to get something moved, and we just do it without even thinking. That's not what, when we have a, we're faced with a refrigerator moving across the apartment problem, we would never lay it down, And that's exactly what happened with the statues, that this is a small remote place with not a lot of resources, and so for the reasons they were doing this statue construction, which from their perspective was ancestor worship, they were going to do it in a way that was going to have the least amount of energy requirement. What's going to be the most the efficient way of doing it? And keeping them standing up is certainly consistent with that. We know that there's direct evidence that these were standing in the quarry themselves. The statues were quarried out of a big cliff, this place called Rano Raraku, was the statue quarry, where 95% of all the statues were quarried. And the locations of the quarry is up high on the cliff, and they actually slide the statues down the side of the cliff to the bottom, where they can then move it out to the places across the island. And what you see often in photos of the island and statues is just the heads standing up. And that's what some people often call these heads. They don't, stone heads of East Rhine. Well, they're actually whole bodies. All the heads that you see actually have full bodies beneath them. They're just buried. And what they're buried in is actually trenches that were dug prehistorically, because the statues are slid down the hill, and then with the bottom facing down, they're slid into a trench, so they're standing. And that way the people could finish the backs, because up until that point they could only get partway underneath the back of the statue. They could finish shaping the back, and then they walk them out of the trenches. Mm. So all the statues you see that are in the quarry with them head sticking out are actually in position to be, once they dug out the trench, to move them out across the landscape. So they start out in a standing position. It seems it's kind of crazy to lay them down, move them, and then pick them back up. You've already got them standing in the first place. If you can keep them standing, all the easier. And when we started to look at the statues themselves, we started to see other evidence that suggested that that's the way they were moved. The bases themselves are shaped in such a way, they're not just any shape, they actually have this sort of D shape with a flat back and a curved front. So when you pull the statue left with ropes on the left and right, the front edge actually acts as a rocking mechanism, and it causes the statue to walk forward.
And there are statues that were broken, so it must be that maybe occasionally one just got away from people.
Exactly. In fact, we find about 35 statues along roads. There are prepared road segments that go from the quarry, stretching out to across the island, where people these are the paths across which statues were moved. And along these paths, we find statues that didn't make it, that fell for whatever reason. And we find them in positions that when they're going downhill, they're on their face, and when they're going uphill, they're on their back. I mean, the positions of the fallen ones are consistent with them falling during transport, just the way you'd expect it, that they were falling over, so they were in a standing position when they were being moved.
Maybe you've got 5-6 minutes left with Carl Lippo. He's professor of archaeology at California State University, Long Beach. We're talking about his book, The Statues That Walked, about Easter Island, and trying to figure out something about who these people were and how they lived and how the place got to be what it was when Europeans got there, and about how the archaeological evidence tells a rather different story than the one that maybe that we have heard. Questions welcome again, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. So then, rather than being this monumental society-wide project where some king or somebody like that says to all the people, now what we're all going to do is, what you all are all going to do is start to make these statues and we're going to put them out, that your argument is that this probably was groups of people, family groups probably, and what they were doing is they said, well, we're going to get together and we're going to make a statue of Grandpa or a statue of Uncle Bill or whatever it is, and we're going to do it, and we're going to do it all together, and then we'll work on moving it, and eventually we'll get it in place.
Yeah, that's key, this idea that people were coming together cooperatively, relatively small groups, multiple groups across the island, coming together cooperatively is really key, I think, to survival. And one of the lessons we can really learn from Easter Island, and we've often learned that Easter Island is this parable of don't do what they did. Let's avoid that. But in fact, there's things that we should follow, and that their survival depended on it, and that thing lessons for us. And one of that is community involvement. People getting together and cooperating and being part of this activity actually provided a more stable base for everyone, since by sharing resources, by contributing to this project, essentially you would buffer out variability in resources that would happen for any individual or any small groups of people, and actually help everyone survive. And we think that's key to this island, and one of the reasons why the statue construction is very monumental and so extravagant is because that's a key bit to their survival, that this is the way in which they were able to maintain their populations. Is by community activity, and the community activity happened to be statue construction. It's something that they brought with them, but that becomes very, very important, specifically on Easter Island.
But also, you're saying that something though about the bigness and the difficulty of it is important too.
Yeah, definitely, there's competition between them, because in any island, in any finite space, you're going to have competition, and this is always the challenge. How do you, as a population, how do you deal with populations? If they're successful, they're going to grow, and if they grow, you have always less resources, and then what do you do? How do you compete? And one area you can compete is warfare. But on an island where you're very isolated and it's very small, warfare is a really bad game to play, because if you try to kill somebody and you're not successful, there's no place you can hide. And even if you are, their relatives are not going to be happy with you, and where are you going to go? It's very difficult to pull off a game of, a lethal game on an island like that. If there's places, in places where we do see warfare in the Pacific, we find, there's other islands that people go somewhere else. They're fighting non-related people. But here, this all your relatives, and you're fighting within them. So what we see competition emerging as is competition of labor, competition of showing what your group can do relative to other people. And so it becomes a very increased investment kind of strategy over time, because the groups are competing with each other to show look how strong we are. We are, we should be able to control these resources because we are the most powerful. And it does it in a way that's non-deadly and doesn't lead to warfare. Yeah.
We just have about a minute. I'm sorry, I have some callers we just can't take. I do want to ask real quickly, though, that it does seem that at one point that very abruptly they stopped making these statues.
Definitely. Dating of the making of the statue is very difficult, because you have a piece of rock and you're wondering, okay, when was this made? And trying to associate a piece of carbon with that is not an easy task. But it looks like people were making statues at least up until contact, maybe even post-1722, up until the Spanish arrived. But at some point they stopped making it. And this points to this idea of the value of making statues is in the sort of quality it gives. It makes you different from other people, because when things that are distinct arrive on the island, European goods, statue construction basically stops, and people start seize the opportunity to get rare goods from Europeans, like hats and clothing and other bits of European good, as evidence of having something that other people don't, and they basically abandon statue construction entirely. So it stops, and the statues, once that point, fall over. All the statues that you see standing were put up since the 1950s by Europeans. At some time during history, though, they were all fallen over. Yeah.
Well, it's a truly fascinating story. Has this created some noise within the archaeology community?
Definitely. There's people who really don't want this story to be... They'd rather the facts not be told, because they think the message of the original story, which is we need to worry about our future, is more important than the facts. And it's challenging a lot of long-held beliefs. I can sympathize with that. We do want to worry about our future. And East Island has always been a good case of, like, let's consider the future. But the facts matter. There's things to be learned from East Island that I think are very important, that these people survived in this very remote, isolated place with terrible sets of resources. And until contact, another place on the island, they didn't. People went extinct or abandoned the island. Here they were successful, and I think there's things to be learned from there. And so we need the facts. The facts matter.
All right. The book is The Statues That Walked, Unraveling the Mystery of Easter Island, published by the Free Press, co-authored by our guest Carl Lippo. He's professor of archaeology at California State University, Long Beach. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you.